Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloh. The successful launch of the James Webb Space Telescope on a European Space Agency Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana on Christmas marked the beginning of one of the greatest scientific endeavors in the history of astronomy. Joining me to take a look at the Webb is my special co-host, Dr. Kendall Hall. Kendall is a physics professor at California State University, Chico, and she has an extensive astrophysics background. And we met serendipitously while I was touring the new science building there when I found out we both have something in common, a love of astronomy. Dr. Kendall Hall, welcome to Blue Dot, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for the wonderful introduction. I'm very excited to be here, and I'm very excited to talk to our special guest today.
Yeah, 100 million human hours and around $10 billion of investment.
Well, this is the biggest telescope that will have, I think, the biggest implications on our field since, I think, Spitzer or Hubble. And Spitzer was launched 12 years ago now, and Hubble was launched in 1990. So it's been a long time coming for something so revolutionary. Now, one thing that I remember is the launch. You know, I think the launch is something that people have been looking forward to for such a long time. I remember when I was doing research as an undergrad in 2015, 2016, my research advisor says, oh, when you go to grad school, you can use the James Webb Space Telescope. And I graduated with my PhD this August. So I did not get to use JWST for my dissertation, but I am really excited that it's finally up there. You know, 75% of the, you know, single failure points have been sort of stepped around. So really, really excited for that. What about you?
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I was just fascinated by the world's largest telescope at the time. It was the 200-inch Hale telescope on Mount Palomar. And, you know, ever since then, I've been fascinated by the next new big thing. You know, the Hubble Space Telescope was amazing and still is. But I've always been fascinated by the history of astronomy and Caltech. So what really excites me about this is our guest today. We've got a really special guest, Dr. Charles Beichmann. He's a senior faculty associate and the director of the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute at Caltech. He's a member of the science team for the James Webb Space Telescope, the near-infrared camera we're going to hear about, NearCam. And he's going to be a big part of the mission's focus on exoplanets. But he's going to tell us about all parts of the mission's history and the potential to make historic discoveries. So if you're ready to go, Kendall, are you ready to talk to Charles Beichmann?
Yes, let's go.
Our guest is Dr. Charles Beichmann. He's a James Webb Space Telescope science team member and the executive director of the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute at Caltech in Pasadena. Charles Beichmann, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's great to be here.
Let's start out with where we are now. As we're recording this, it's January 6th. You know, for Mars missions, there's the famous 7 minutes of terror as we wait to see if the rover, like Curiosity or Perseverance, land safely. James Webb Space Telescope launched on Christmas Day. It's so far things are going well. But tell us, you know, how would you give us the analog for this? It's like, you know, what, 29 days of anxiousness?
Yeah, it's sort of 29 days of high anxiety. There are literally hundreds of activities and deployments that have to happen smoothly in the right sequence for the mission to be a success. So imagine a butterfly emerging from a cocoon or an origami telescope unfolding to its full size. There's a lot that has to happen. But fortunately, as of today, many of the key developments have gone off perfectly.
Wow. And what else needs to happen? We've deployed the sun shield now and what, the secondary mirror? What else has to happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, starting on Christmas Day, the Christmas gift to all astronomy was watching the solar panel deploy as seen by the separating upper stage of the Ariane launch vehicle, the high gain antenna. As you mentioned, the solar shade, all five layers of it have been stretched out across a an area the size of a tennis court. They've been tensioned properly, and they maintain the temperature differential between eventually the telescope at about minus 230 degrees centigrade and then room temperature for the spacecraft. The sunshade has an SPF of about a million.
Wow.
The tripod holding the secondary mirror is locked into place, and that secondary mirror gathers the light rays from the big 21-foot primary mirror, gets aimed up at the secondary, and then the secondary bounces it back to the instruments located behind the primary mirror itself. So the last big deployment in the next 2 days are the two outer wings of the primary mirror. Think about a dining room table that has two drop-down leaves. Over the next 2 days, first one will lock into place, then the other will lock into place. And that's all the major structural deployments. There's still a lot more to go, but the major big structural ones will be behind us. And now it's time for the detailed optimization of the telescope and the instruments.
Let's talk a bit about the history of this telescope, because it's long and it's gone through, you know, quite a few problems and cost overruns. But, you know, here we finally are. I also find it fascinating, you know, we're talking to you, an astronomer from Caltech. And, you know, if you look at the history of Caltech, it's tied into the history of astronomy quite deeply, with the world's largest telescopes were built, you know, for the service of astronomy there in Pasadena, the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson, the 200-inch telescope on Mount Palomar, like the Keck telescope in Hawaii. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, the lineage of the Caltech connection to James Webb Space Telescope?
Well, what's amazing is that, you know, Webb really is the acme of the final point, maybe not the final point, but the next big step in the revolution in astronomical telescopes. As you mentioned, that started out on the ground at the first telescopes at Mount Wilson, which really led to the discovery that galaxies were independent distant star clusters, that they were expanding, that the universe, the galaxies were moving away, so the universe was expanding. That, of course, was work done by, among other people, Edwin Hubble, after the Hubble telescope was named. Then we had the Palomar telescope, which led to the discovery of quasars, the center of the galaxy. Then the Keck telescopes, which was the first real break in the design of telescopes by having a segmented mirror. And that, of course, is the design that JWST had adopted, so you could make a telescope that was larger than the fairing around a launch vehicle. So that lineage is certainly reflected in Webb. And in space, there's another whole thrust that also goes through Pasadena, which is a lot of the early work in infrared astronomy, both on the ground, you know, with the work by Gary Neugebauer, Eric Becklin, the first space infrared telescope, IRAS in the early 80s, then the Spitzer telescope, and now we've had Hubble and Spitzer, you know, which together bring the visible and IR wavelengths together. And now, of course, we have Webb and Hubble, which will work together. So it's really just a super exciting time for astronomy. And the power of Webb is really going to be so dramatic.
Yeah.
Kendall Nubby, you go ahead and ask the next one.
Yes. So great segue. You're speaking about Hubble. And one of the things that I'm pretty interested in is that Hubble had an orbit that went around Earth, whereas, you know, JWST is going to orbit the sun. And specifically, it's going to orbit about and through a specific thing called the second Lagrange point. And I was wondering if you could speak to the importance of that and why this decision was made, you know, to differ from Hubble, or from WISE's sun synchronous orbit, which was the Wide Infrared Survey Explorer. So I was just wondering if you could speak on the importance of the specific orbit of JWST.
I think there's two reasons that make that were really drivers for putting Webb out a million miles away from the Earth. First is because you want to cool web down to these low temperatures so it's sensitive to the heat radiation, the infrared radiation that we want to study, is if you're too close to the Earth is itself a giant heat lamp. So you just want to get away from the thermal load that the Earth would present to Webb, so you can cool down the entire telescope, you know, this passive cooling. And this was first demonstrated with the Spitzer telescope, which went into a similar orbit, drifting away from the Earth. The second reason is, when if you ever have observed with Hubble, one of the things you know is every 45 minutes, you better change the direction you're looking at, because if not, you're going to, instead of be looking at some star or planet or galaxy, you may wind up looking right through the Earth. So that just being so close to the Earth in low Earth orbit is a real constraint on how much of the sky you can observe at any one time and for how long. With Webb being a million miles away from the Earth, you basically can look unobstructedly at half the sky at any one time for many, many hours and even days uninterrupted. So those are the major advantages. You can get colder and you just have unblocked access to the sky for long periods of time. So the efficiency of the observatory can be very, very high.
So one thing that I think people might be wondering is that Hubble has this great legacy. It's produced wonderful images. And part of that is because it is an optical telescope, seeing what our eyes could see, again, if they could look at the sky for the same amount of time. So why is JBST in the infrared? What will that tell us? You know, what will that tell us that Hubble couldn't tell us?
Now, the two wavelengths are going to be just enormously complementary. As you mentioned, Hubble observes the world in visible light like our own eyes. JWST looks at infrared or heat radiation. So think of one of these thermal imaging cameras that you may have seen. If you live in a cold climate, you may have an expert come out and look at your house to see where the heat is leaking out and where you need to put in some extra insulation. You wouldn't see that just with visible light. Or you want to look to see if a person has a fever. If their temperature is higher, they'll have a warmer face that you'll be able to pick them out and say, oh, you got a fever. So the infrared just gives you different information, and the combination is very valuable. Another big effect of the infrared is because of the expansion of the universe, this Doppler redshift, as these galaxies and distant objects are receding from us, it moves their visible or even ultraviolet wavelengths out into the infrared. So if you want to study the optical or UV light from a distant galaxy or a quasar, that could be redshifted by a factor of 10 or more from the UV out to the infrared. So if you want to study the most distant objects in the universe, you really want to work at infrared wavelengths. And then finally, and this is something I know, Kendall, is of interest to you, studying star formation and giant gas and dust clouds, the infrared lets you look through the dust. The reason sunsets are red is the red light makes it through, whereas the blue light is scattered away. So if you can look through the dust, you can look down into the cores of these molecular clouds and find stars or planets in the process of formation. So these are the real advantages that people have known about for many years, and why we built the IRAS satellite and the Spitzer satellite. But now with Webb, we have a much bigger telescope than Spitzer, better detectors, much larger format detectors. So Webb is going to make fabulous images, and we're going to be able to compare them with Hubble's images and really just see what the comparison can show us.
Ooh, and that's what's cool about this telescope, is it's going to enable us to really probe that area, isn't it?
Right. I mean, we're just going to go right back to the, and it's one of the real things Webb was designed to do, is to, look at the very first generation of stars and stars and galaxies, and look at galaxies really as they're first forming in the first few hundred million years after the Big Bang. It's really their ultraviolet light that we're seeing. It's going to be redshifted into infrared wavelengths, a redshift of, you know, a factor of 10 or more. And their UV light will start to shine through. And it's really this era of reionizing the gas after the Big Bang and starting to make the universe transparent and making the galaxies and setting the stage for the formation of the generation of stars and planets and eventually life in the universe we're inhabiting. So it's that first steps in cosmology that'll be so important to study with Webb.
Yeah, I love that too. It almost sounds like something out of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Redshift factor 10.
Right.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as Dr. Kendall Hall and I will continue our look at the James Webb Space Telescope with Caltech astrophysicist Charles Beichmann. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue now as CSU Chico physics professor Dr. Kendall Hall and I visit with Caltech's Charles Beichmann as we talk about the James Webb Space Telescope. Let's talk about the basics of this telescope. Kind of take us through the pathway of the infrared light as it enters the telescope. You know, take us through what happens once it reaches Webb to get to the instruments.
Okay, well, I mean, the primary mirror's got these 18 hexagonal mirrors that are all sort of nested together to make about a 21-foot, 6.5-meter primary mirror. You know, the mirrors are made out of beryllium, which is super lightweight metal, and coated with less than an ounce of gold, which is highly reflective in the infrared. And the primary mirror operates as this coherent mirror that sends the light up to the secondary mirror about 20-some feet in front of the primary. The secondary focuses the light and sends its backs down to the four instruments that sit in an instrument module bolted to the back of the telescope. So the first thing that's going to be happening after these big deployments is the primary mirror and the secondary mirror all have to get very carefully aligned. So instead of 18, you know, small mirrors flying in close formation, they're completely aligned with each other to a precision of a few hundredths of a human hair and aligned so they form one big diffraction limited mirror. And then it gets into the different instruments. So Webb has four different instruments that are also cooled down. So the instrument I've been involved with is the NIRCam, near infrared camera instrument, that's a wide field camera, a lot of different filters, a simple spectrometer, and one of the things I'm going to be using, a coronagraph, which allows us to block out the brightness of a central star to let us look for planets surrounding the central star. But NIRCam will also be used to make these really, really deep images for cosmology and everything in between. And then about after 4 or 5 months of optimization, we start getting science data.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. And I'm sure you are too. Kendall, go ahead with the next one.
Yeah. So first I want to ask about, you've said the word spectrometer a few times, and I was wondering if you could elaborate what that means, as you've said resolution. But in astronomy, there are many different types of resolution. So could you speak to whether this means that we can really distinguish wavelengths of light from each other, or whether we can see very tiny objects very far away?
All of the above. So I agree, astronomers talk a bit glibly about these things. So first, a spectrometer, in its simplest guise, think about a prism with sunlight shining through a prism, and you get a little rainbow displayed. And, you know, that was really first done, in fact, by William Herschel, who showed you could disperse the white light from the sun through a prism and see the component colors. And that's really all a spectrometer does. We have lots of fancier ways of doing that. The advantage of that is if you can disperse the light into more and more gradations of color, you start to notice that, for example, in sunlight, there are dark bands and occasionally some bright bands. And those dark bands are places where there are atoms in the atmosphere of the sun where certain elements are absorbing light. And each element in the periodic table has a very characteristic set of fingerprints of wavelengths at which they either absorb or emit light depending on the physical conditions. And you can use a spectrometer that gives you these gradations of color to say, aha, in this particular star, or planet, or galaxy, I can see evidence for hydrogen or helium. Helium, in fact, was first discovered in the sun before it was even discovered in the laboratory. People said, gee, there's this funny spectral line and we don't know what it's from, but we'll name it after the sun, Helios. And then it turned out it was helium. And then you can see molecules. You could see spectral lines of water vapor, of carbon dioxide, of methane. Particularly as you move into the infrared, you see molecules even more than you do individual atoms. So it's a very powerful technique that astronomers have developed to use spectrometers to break the light into its component colors. And depending on what particular spectrometer you use, you can use a prism, you can use a grating, you can use other techniques, you can get very high spectral resolution that lets you look in great detail at a spectral line, or you can use something that gives you broader coverage to look at a whole variety of lines at one time. And Webb has a variety of these spectrometers that let you take advantage of these different capabilities. As you mentioned, we also use resolution to mean angular resolution. How well can you separate, you know, two objects located close together and say, ah, there's two stars there, not just one? A smaller telescope, you might just see a blob and say, well, maybe there's two there. Webb, with its big mirror, will let you separate a blurry image and say, yeah, there's actually two stars or three stars there, or gee, there's two galaxies that are colliding into each other that I couldn't have seen without the angular capability that Webb brings with this big 6.5 meter mirror.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. And I absolutely love the trivia about helium being named after the sun, because that's where we first saw it. The resolution of James Webb is beyond most of what we've seen even in past space telescopes. But I've read and seen that James WST doesn't only have unprecedented sensitivity in these ways, but there was also new mechanics invented. Could you speak a little bit about the micro shutter system and what that might be able to help us accomplish?
Sure. So one of the traditional spectrometer, you know, can maybe look at one object at a time. You put the entrance of the spectrometer on the star, the galaxy you want to study, and you get a spectrum of it. Then if you have another object, you go over and look at it, then you go look at another one. And it's quite time consuming, even if you have a big, powerful telescope like Webb. But there's another design of spectrometer where you can make what we call a multi-slit aperture, where you can open and close. You have, just imagine a little grid of shutters, a few hundred of them, and you can open and close any one of them. And so if, let's say you have a field of galaxies or a field of stars, and you want to get a spectrum of 100 at a time, you just open the correct shutter, and galaxy one goes into shutter open one, galaxy two goes into shutter open number five over here, galaxy number three goes into shutter position number seven, and you open the ones that you want. Oh, there's a bright star, we don't like that, we'll keep that shutter closed. And in that way, you can build up a spectrum, not one at a time, but 100 at a time. So your valuable web time doesn't just get you one galaxy spectrum and a cluster of galaxies, but 100 all at once. And so this little micro shutter array is just a wonderful piece of micro silicon engineering that they developed to let us do that.
The engineering on this is just so amazing. You know, it uses a beryllium gold-plated mirror. I mean, who doesn't want one of those? the cryo cooler that keeps the temperature of that instrument you were talking about at 7 Kelvin. You know, that isn't, you know, can you just explain to our listeners how cold that is?
Well, it's colder than it is outside my front door up here in British Columbia, that's for sure. It's, you know, 7 degrees above absolute zero centigrade. You know, pretty much any gas you can think of has solidified, with maybe the exception of helium. But that lets the detectors that MIRI uses, the infrared instrument, be so cold that there's no interfering radiation, thermal radiation from anywhere else, you know, in the instrument itself or from the detectors themselves. And that is what gives Webb its incredible sensitivity at these wavelengths. I mean, because it's so cold, you know, Webb can detect the heat of a bumblebee at the moon. I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
Wow.
How the small amount of heat that Webb can detect because the telescope is cold, the detectors are cold, and it's all optimized to work together.
Well, let's talk a bit about the duration of this mission. It's, you know, it's supposed to go for 5, but it probably will go for 10. You've got to kind of station keep your orbit out there at L2, which means you do have to, you know, make little course corrections periodically. So you do need to rely on a fuel lifetime. And is it possible that, you know, 10 years from now, there will be the capability to go refuel it robotically,
right,
or otherwise?
I mean, the goal and what's really been achieved so far is, I mean, Webb was put into its trajectory with the Ariane rocket, and they did a great job. And then the onboard fuel has two uses on Webb itself. One is to give the final adjustments to the trajectory so that Webb gets to the right orbit at L2 and then stops there, and that takes a little bit more fuel. And because the injection by the Ariane rocket was so good, they're able to minimize the amount of fuel it takes for the mid-course corrections. And that leaves more fuel left over for what we call the station keeping and just the, you know, the maintenance of the orbit out there. So they had consumables on board for 10 years. So there should be fuel for at least a 10-year mission, and maybe more, because the initial orbital injection was so good by the Ariane. And it'll be a while before they have the final estimates of that. So there's no capability that we presently have
to service it.
But there's certainly ideas out there, and some basic, you know, retroreflectors and so on were put on so that, you know, if the capability came to pass to do some sort of robotic refueling, you know, that people could, you know, talk about that on the time scale of, you know, 5 to, you know, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Well, at the moment, everybody's just really happy to get it out there and working for the nominal 10 years. But you can be sure that as people, you know, start facing, oh my God, Webb could go away, but if we could refuel it, we could do this great job, I'm sure there'll be people very interested in pursuing that project.
Yeah. And speaking of that 10 years, you know, observation is what this is all about. And I'm sure you can't wait to get to work. Could you tell us, like, when will science really start? And give us just briefly, without going too far into the weeds, briefly tell us how you go about allocating observation time for Webb.
Yeah, so Webb, you know, was launched on Christmas, and there's roughly a 6-month period of getting the telescope deployed, the telescope optimized so it points well, it's stable, and then the instruments get optimized. So something like early June, science observations will start to get done. So these will be what we call cycle one observations, and there's actually an annual cycle of soliciting proposals from the community and selecting them and then scheduling them for observations in the cycle two, cycle three, and beyond. So cycle one has a combination of proposals from the broad community, and roughly about 300, 280 something were selected, roughly one in four, one in five of those, you know, that were submitted, you know, about almost 300 were selected. Then separately, there were previously approved programs from the different instrument teams. And that'll be cycle one about 6 or 8 months from now, once there's some first data for everyone to look at. There'll be a call for cycle two proposals, and everyone will write proposals. It'll be, you know, again, very competitive, and some fraction of one in four, one in five will get selected, and that'll become cycle two, and so on.
Let's take a quick break, but when we come back, physics professor Kendall Hall and I will continue our look at all things James Webb Space Telescope with Caltech's Charles Beichman. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, my special guest host is Kendall Hall, physics professor at California State University, Chico. Let's return now to our look at all things James Webb Space Telescope with the executive director of the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute at the California Institute of Technology, Dr. Charles Beichman.
One thing I think that the audience may be questioning is, why can't we do this science from the ground? Why do we have to send telescopes into space?
Couple of reasons. You know, astronomers like having an atmosphere because, like everybody else, we like to breathe. Telescopes don't like an atmosphere. They distort the images of the stars just because the atmosphere is shimmery and, you know, you can just sort of see the stars twinkling, and that makes it just harder to make the most sensitive possible observations with the best possible angular resolution. So when Hubble went into space with just a 2.4 meter telescope, it made images of really just unprecedented clarity and sensitivity. If you add to it, you want to then work at infrared wavelengths. There's two new big advantages that come in. First, the atmosphere itself and the telescope are all warm. They have to be at room temperature. That means they're all giving off heat radiation. So if you want to be sensitive to heat radiation from celestial objects, you want to be able to cool your telescope down. And you just can't do that from the ground. So if you want to, and Spitzer and Webb afterwards are literally a million times faster at making an observation at the infrared because there's no competing thermal background from the telescope or the atmosphere once you're in space. So something that would take you, you know, 30 seconds of observation with Webb would take you a year with the Keck telescope at the same wavelength. So it's just a profound difference that you get going into space. And then finally, there are just wavelengths of light that don't make it through the Earth's atmosphere. There's water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere that blankets many, many parts of the wavelength region that you'd like to study. Also, CO2 and all these different molecules block our view of the sky. So you get above the atmosphere, you get more sensitive, you get more wavelengths, you get undistorted images. And this is why space is just such a great place for astronomy to go.
That is so cool. All right, let's talk about some of the scientific goals for this telescope. Let's talk about, first of all, early cosmology, the Big Bang. What are some of the things that, you know, we're going to investigate with this telescope?
One of the first things Webb is going to do is stare at what looks like a fairly blank piece of sky and just make the deepest, most sensitive observations that have ever been made at these wavelengths. And that's going to start to reveal these very distant objects. And in this mode, JWST is operating like a time machine, looking at the most distant and thus the oldest objects in the universe. These are going to be the first galaxies caught in the process of formation just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. The first generation of stars and galaxies as they start to collapse out of the primordial gas to create the first stars and galaxies. And that's just going to tell us how galaxies and the elements that we eventually use to make planets and life, how those formed.
One topic that is close to my heart is stellar evolution. Now, I admit that I searched for your PhD thesis, and your thesis was on the formation of late O and early B stars, so big stars, and how they form. So I'm wondering if James Webb will revolutionize how we understand how stars evolve.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that Webb will be able to do is to look deep into the cores of these gas clouds, gas and dust clouds that, you know, are the natal regions for stars to form. And with the infrared, you get to look through that and see down deep into the core, and you can use the spectrometers to analyze the very early stages of these forming stars, what we call class zero or class one, and what are their temperatures, what are their physical conditions, you know, what is the disk surrounding them like, how does that lead to the formation of planets? And that's something that Webb's sensitivity and angular resolution will really help with a lot.
Cool. What about your particular area of study, exoplanets? What are the planets beyond our solar system? What are some of the really interesting research topics that Webb can address?
Well, we've got two different techniques that people are going to use. The one I'm pursuing most directly is the direct imaging technique, where we're going to use both the NIRCam and MIRI coronagraphs to look for planets or to characterize known planets around some of the brightest nearby stars. Objects like Vega, Fomalhaut, Epsilon Arae, Alpha Centauri. We're going to look at them with Webb's great sensitivity and say, okay, can we see a planet that's maybe the size of Saturn or Jupiter compared to current ground-based limits, which are maybe 5 to 7 times the mass of Jupiter. So Webb can let us drop the sensitivity to lower levels to look for sort of distant planets around these objects. So that's one case. And the other one is to use the transit technique, where we've seen objects like the TRAPPIST-1 planetary system and many, many others found by Kepler and TESS satellites, where when a planet goes in front of or behind its star, you can use that time to differentiate the light of the planet from the light of the star. And if you pass the light through a spectrometer, as we discussed earlier, you can use the dispersed colors to say, aha, there's water, there's methane, there's carbon dioxide, there's, you know, there's different atoms all in the atmospheres of these planets. You can use that to see if there's weather and winds on the planets. There's a large variety of physical information and atmospheric characterization that we'll do with the transit technique. And we'll do that for gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn, and smaller ones like Uranus and Neptune, but we'll be pushing down into the rocky planets as well. And one of the best cases may be this planetary system orbiting the star TRAPPIST-1. And they're a bunch of Earth-sized planets, you know, some a bit hotter than the habitable zone, some a bit colder, but, you know, we may not find oxygen, but we'd certainly say whether these rocky planets have an atmosphere and some basic measures of whether they might have carbon dioxide or water. And I think the combination of the transits and the direct imaging are really just going to be a fantastic revolution for exoplanet science.
Where were you when Webb launched? Were you at home? And did you get to go see the telescope when it was in its final assembly stages there in Redondo Beach? Have you actually been able to see the telescope up close and personal?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times, both when it was in early assembly back at the Goddard Space Flight Center, and then it was pretty much built up completely down at Northrop Grumman down in Palos Verdes. So yeah, I was able to see it a couple of different times, and it is just one impressive beast on the ground. And I just, hard to say how thrilling it was. I was actually up in Seattle with my daughter for Christmas, and for Christmas Day, to watch that solar panel deploy as it drifted away from the upper stage of the Ariane was just the culmination of well over 15 years worth of work.
Well, we already touched on this briefly, but I think this is a nice note to end on, which is, do you think that it's feasible we can actually service Webb so that it can continue and have a long legacy like the Hubble Space Telescope?
It's certainly possible. They put some minimal capabilities on Webb that would allow another spacecraft to come up, approach it, and potentially hook up, you know, a gas tank and fill it up with the hydrazine. It's a complicated thing, and I think nobody's thought about it in any detail since, of course, they're completely focused on getting Webb up and working for its first 10 years. But, you know, once everybody, the engineers have recovered from getting all that done, I'm sure there are some imaginative people who will start to think about, gee, what could we do next to top what we've already done? So it's certainly not impossible. It'll take some infrastructure we don't currently have. But somewhere the combination of NASA and Elon Musk can probably come up with something that would work.
Well, that's, yeah, who knows what could happen, you know, down the road. Look at how much has changed just in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years with SpaceX and things like that.
I mean, I think it's most likely that it would be robotic surfacing. I don't see at all the prospect of it being human involved, because the infrastructure send humans out to L2 and bring them back safely is more complexity.
It's pretty resource intensive.
Yeah, that's very resource intensive. Whereas a good robotic mission, you know, that'd be a good challenge. People are already talking about refueling satellites in geosynchronous orbit to extend the lives of communication satellites and so on. So that's a logical extension of the technology that's already being developed.
Well, Charles Beichmann, astronomer from Caltech and scientist on the James Webb Space Telescope team, thanks so much for joining us and sharing all your knowledge about this really exciting mission.
Well, it's really just been a great pleasure, and contact us again in 6 months when we start getting data.
Oh, you can count on that. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Charles Beichmann, James Webb Space Telescope science team member and the executive director of the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute at Caltech. So, Kendall, you know, now that we got to talk to Charles Beichmann, what's your quick big takeaway?
That, you know, even though I'm in this community, I don't think I realized how much science James Webb can accomplish. And by that, I mean how many topics within astronomy, from cosmology, which is this the big world, big universe perspective, down to the resolution of protoplanetary disks, which are the disks of gas and dust around stars that are actively forming planets, down to, you know, seeing emission from molecules, you know, so it's just such a big range of stuff that this telescope can accomplish. And I think that until now, I think that's kind of been lost on me. I think a lot of astronomers get focused on their very subtopic. For me, that's astrochemistry and studying molecule formation and the formation of clouds, a little bit the formation of stars. So I think the biggest takeaway for me is just how much James Webb can do.
Yeah, very cool. Well, we're going to go, but I hope you're going to join me again a few months down the road when we actually start getting some science back. So can we do that? Can we get you back?
Cannot wait.
Finally, I asked our good friend, NASA Apollo-era flight director and former director of the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Jerry Griffin, to join us to talk about the man the space telescope is named for, James Webb. Hey, Jerry.
Good morning or afternoon or wherever you are.
Wherever, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, Jerry.
That's right.
And Jerry, the other day you were telling me about NASA Administrator James Webb. He was the first administrator, right?
No, he was actually the second.
Second?
The first guy was named Keith Glennon.
Oh, right.
Okay. Was not there too long, but and then along came Jim.
Well, you were telling me a really cool story about him the other day that I thought would be nice to share with our listeners, because everybody's hearing about the James Webb Space Telescope, but it would be nice to know about the person it's named after. So I was wondering if you'd share that with us.
Yeah, you know, when I came into NASA 1964, James Webb was the administrator, and he was kind of a bigger than life sort of guy. I never got to meet him because I was too low in the pay scale to do that. But everybody thought of him as a very strong leader. It took me a while to kind of figure out why that was, because I had read that he was administrator, but what did he do? Well, he was Undersecretary of State. He was the former head of the Bureau of the Budget, which later became the OMB, that is all the financial side of Washington. I think in retrospect, his greatest strength was his knowledge of how to get things done in Washington. And remember, this was back in the day when the two parties cooperated, but you had to have people that would compromise, and you generally kind of had have somebody to lead that discussion. And I think Webb was great at it. They tell a story about him. I've heard it in several forms, but the one that I really like actually came out of a fellow named Robert Siemens, who was associate administrator at the time that this event that I'm about to explain happened. And it really is to show you how moxie I think Webb was. They were putting together the budget, the final budget for the Apollo program at NASA headquarters. The guys that crunched the numbers came up with a number that said, oh, it'll be $6 or $7 billion. So amongst these guys at the headquarters, they said, you know, it would be very easy to underestimate this. We probably ought to bump that up to about $7 or maybe even $10 billion. So they went to Webb with a $10 billion figure. And he looked it over. He was getting ready to send it, this package, over to the White House. He looked it over and he marked out and said, redo this. Instead of $10 billion, make it $20 billion. And that was by the stroke of his pen. He called it the administrator's discount. And it went to Johnson first, Lyndon Johnson, and then on to Kennedy. And it was approved at the $20 billion level. Well, the final price tag was $24 billion. By the way, that amounts in today's dollar about $200 billion.
Wow.
But Webb's knowledge of how big he had probably seen them come his way at the Bureau of the Budget more than once, and particularly on the first of a kind deal, they overran every time. They couldn't do it with what they said. So he used his kind of inside knowledge. We better up this thing. And he did it on his own. And it shows you again how I think he was the right person at the right time in our history to get us to the moon. And he came very, very close to that $20 billion estimate.
Wow, that's such a great story. And he was also a big supporter of science in NASA.
Yes, he was. He was a all-around person that I think just understood. He understood what it took to do these kinds of things. He understood technology enough, I think, that he could project what it was going to be in the future if they could be successful. And getting to the moon was the game on the table, and he figured out how to play that game.
Well, Jerry Griffin, former director of the Johnson Space Center in Houston and flight director for the Apollo program, thanks for sharing those interesting stories with us about James Webb, so we get a sense of who this space telescope is named after.
Well, it's always fun talking to you, Dave.
Thanks again to our special guest host, Dr. Kendall Hall, physics professor from California State University, Chico, Dr. Charles Beichmann from Caltech, and our great friend, retired NASA flight director, Jerry Griffin. You can learn more about the James Webb Space Telescope at jwst.nasa.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @BlueDotNSPR. Our social media coordinator is Angela Ostarello. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.